is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. During a virtual news conference, White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby says they have received Hamas's response to the Gaza ceasefire plan.
We've been eagerly awaiting a response. But as for the reported details that may be out there, I think I'm just going to demur right now. We've only just gotten it. Our team is going through it. As I understand, the Qataris and the Egyptians are as well. And I think we just need to reserve comment until we've had a chance to fully examine it.
Hamas and the smaller Islamic Jihad militant group said on Tuesday that they were ready to deal positively to arrive at an agreement, and their priorities to bring complete stop to the war. A senior Hamas official said they had submitted some remarks on the proposal to the mediators but did not elaborate. Meanwhile, U.S. officials are working to see if a United Nations-backed ceasefire proposal becomes reality. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon.
Speaking in Tel Aviv, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called a statement from Hamas supporting the ceasefire, quote, a hopeful sign, but not enough.
The word coming from Gaza and from the Hamas leadership in Gaza, that's what counts, and that's what we don't have yet.
Getting that buy-in, though, may be difficult, given what American officials say comes next for the U.S. designated terror group. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, Washington.
Eight people from Tajikistan with suspected ties to the Islamic State group have been arrested in the United States in recent days, according to multiple people familiar with the matter. The arrests took place in New York, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles, and the individuals who entered the U.S. through the southern border are being held in immigration violations, according to the people who were not authorized to discuss the ongoing investigation and spoke on condition of anonymity. This is VOA News. Eight people, again, have been arrested and taken into custody as a result. And in Ukraine,
the State Department has removed restrictions on the transfer of American weapons and training to a high-profile Ukrainian military unit with a checkered past. Officials say the Azov Brigade passed a vetting process that found it had not committed any gross human rights violations. The move will help the brigade, among Ukraine's most effective and popular, move beyond its reputation as a far-right movement, a perception its commanders have been trying to dispel as Russian propaganda. Moscow has repeatedly portrayed the Azov as a Nazi group and accused it of atrocities, but given no evidence. I'm Charles Diledesma.
Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, said on Tuesday that the vice president, Saulus Chilima, and nine other people were killed when the military plane they were traveling on crashed. The aircraft carrying Chilima was seen as a potential candidate in next year's presidential election and went missing on Monday.
In the Chikangawa forest, and they have found it completely destroyed with no survivors, as all passengers on board were killed on impact.
The plane left the capital but was unable to land Monday at an airport as scheduled due to poor visibility. It was ordered to return but went off the radar, and aviation authorities could not make contact with it. Nigeria's military has denied allegations of inhumane treatment toward women and girls who survive Boko Haram and are military custody. And the report by rights group Amnesty International accuses the military of various violations, including unlawful detention and neglect. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Nigerian Defense Authorities rejected Amnesty International's reporting, saying that military personnel operate within the scope of international laws of conflict. A statement said the military has, quote, self-regulating mechanisms to address any proven case of misconduct, end quote, by its operatives. The report from Amnesty International, titled Help Us Build Our Lives, said women and girls who survived Boko Haram captivity were subjected to further suffering, including prolonged unlawful detention by the military and inadequate support by authorities for them to rebuild their lives. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The Mexican authorities are using a simple but harsh tactic to deal with migrants trying to get to the U.S. They're wearing them out until they give up. Mexico is driven by mounting pressure from the U.S. to block millions of people headed to the north. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
charges.
No one in this country is above the law. Everyone must be accountable for their actions.
Hamas haggles over ceasefire language.
A senior Hamas official said on Tuesday the Palestinian militant group had accepted a United Nations-backed ceasefire resolution and is ready to negotiate details.
And a private club in Los Angeles, where the dogs are members and the humans are the guests.
At this Los Angeles members-only club, scoring an invite is all about who you know.
Today is Wednesday, June 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
No one in this country is above the law.
Hunter Biden, son of U.S. President Joe Biden, has become the first child of a sitting U.S. president to be convicted of a crime.
Hunter Biden was convicted of two counts of lying on a form submitted to a federal firearms dealer about his addiction or use of crack cocaine, and possessing a firearm while a user or addict. There have been two overarching themes emphasized by the prosecution during trial: this defendant's illegal choices and the rule of law.
Special Counsel David Weiss.
No one in this country is above the law. Everyone must be accountable for their actions, even this defendant. However, Hunter Biden should be no more accountable than any other citizen convicted of this same conduct. The prosecution has been and will continue to be committed to this principle.
President Biden put out this statement, quote, "I am the president, but I am also a dad. Jill and I love our son, and we are so proud of the man he is today. So many families who have had loved ones battle addiction understand the feeling of pride seeing someone you love come out the other side and be so strong and resilient in recovery. As I also said last week, I will accept the outcome of this case and will continue to respect the judicial process as Hunter considers an appeal," unquote. Victoria Norse is a Georgetown law professor and former general counsel to Joe Biden when he was vice president.
Well, I'm sure it's very sad for his family and sad for Hunter Biden. Many people have know individuals who have suffered from addiction. And I think people can understand that. On the other hand, I think it is a good day for the rule of law. We don't have people outside the courtroom saying, burn it down. We don't have people saying, you know, democracy is at an end, that it's part of a racket. And our institutions are strong. And the president has indicated already he will not pardon his son. I think his family has been through a lot, but I think they also understand the stakes today, which are that our institutions have to stay strong.
So let's dig into this. VOA's Lori London spoke with criminal defense attorney Jack Rice for reaction to the verdict and a look at what comes next.
Actually, it doesn't surprise me. When we look at the evidence that seemed to be presented by the feds in this case, it was pretty solid. It was pretty consistent with what we see with certain requirements and the obligations to prove their case. And they did. They brought in people very close to Hunter Biden. And those people came in and they talked about his use. They talked about him being out of control. They talked about all sorts of things. Plus, they brought in a lot of other evidence to talk about sort of his efforts to possess or purchase. And all of those are things you can't do when you're under the influence and you have possessions of weapons. Pretty simple.
So what does this verdict mean for Hunter Biden?
Well, according to the guidelines, technically he could be looking at up to 10 years on two of the counts, 5 years on one of the counts. But the guidelines really are somewhere between 15 and 21 months. That being said, it's very, very common that somebody who's convicted of this could do less than that, and sometimes even no time based upon that, based upon what happens between right now and the sentencing. There's going to be a pre-sentence investigation. It takes, I don't know, about 3 months. So this should probably be sometime in late September, sometimes maybe October. And between now and then, the judge is going to have to decide what to do with Hunter Biden.
What would be the factors for deciding that punishment?
When we look at it, you'll look at his prior record. You'll look at how complicated this case was, his ability to probation, his connection and cooperation throughout the entire process, and whether or not it's best in the mind of society, realistically. I also think at this point, what we never really saw was that he misused these. It was simply possession. So if we look at the seriousness of the charges in sort of the panoply of what these could have been, these are really less serious in the context of possession of a firearm, certainly when you rise to the level of the feds getting involved versus state, and that's much different.
What are Hunter Biden's options at this point following this verdict?
Well, he has the ability to appeal this if he wants to, but realistically, that's probably not going to stop what it is the judge is going to do when it comes to the sentencing process. That is still going to happen. But I think the logical step for Hunter Biden, even though he has done this in the past, is to continue to establish that he's not using, to establish this question of chemical dependency issue and abuse issues. And if that means more treatment, if that means more inpatient, outpatient processes, whatever it is that he can do to show the court that he's not a danger to society, I think that's going to make a huge difference for him. And frequently when I'm dealing with like this, dealing with this with a lot of clients that I have, one of the first things we will do is get them into an inpatient program someplace in the United States that might be very, very applicable to something like this, to show the court that not only is he taking it seriously, not only is he addressing these underlying issues, but also he respects what the court is doing, and he's showing that he's prepared to do what is necessary to make sure that this never happens again.
My understanding that this sort of charge, though, for this particular issue is very, very rare. Some are thinking that it's political. Is this a rare thing to be putting these kinds of charges forward on, having only had this gun for 11 days?
We don't see charges like this very much. We really don't. When we're usually seeing gun charges in federal court, what that usually means is people like felons in possession of firearms. That's usually what we'll see. It's use of the firearm in some way, or some person who shouldn't have it. And normally when you get somebody who shouldn't have it, it's frequently somebody who has a felony record, potentially domestic assault convictions, certain kinds of crimes that they've already been convicted of that basically say you are not allowed to have this kind of weapon. So then what they'll do is they prosecute based upon that. And even those are usually really serious because most of those are prosecuted in state court. But to prosecute them in federal court, they need to be even more egregious. This is actually not even that. So it is unusual. There's much more involved to this because they thought they had a plea agreement previously. It got kicked back by the feds because he actually has two trials, and ultimately this one was going to be dismissed. But because it didn't, they moved forward with it, and as a result, here we sit.
Hunter Biden is also facing more jeopardy, legal jeopardy, coming up in September with another trial on the horizon related to tax evasion issues. Is that more serious, and will that also impact any of this?
Tax evasion charges are actually far more serious than this kind of a gun charge. And so that's actually the one that he needs to be most concerned about. If you consider the plea agreement that he had in place previously, he was going to have to plead guilty to the tax evasion charges, and they were going to dismiss the gun charge. That tells you in itself how the feds see the distinction. They find the tax evasion issue to be a more serious, more egregious issue. And so Hunter Biden should be more concerned about tax evasion convictions than he really needs to be in this particular case. Now, as it comes to the sentencing question, the possibility is he's supposed to start trial in September. And he probably would be sentenced in October or so on the gun charges. They could potentially continue those if he is in trial in California on those federal tax evasion charges. So this could take a bit longer, and we may not have an answer until after the election day in November, although why the election day matters to Hunter Biden is still a bit beyond me, because he's not running for office. Hunter Biden is a private citizen, and some people seem to be continuing to tie this to the sitting president, President Biden. It's an interesting thing because there's no evidence of any kind. And certainly Republicans in the House have been trying for at least 18 months to make the argument that somehow Hunter Biden's behavior is tied to President Biden. But at least as of this point, we have no evidence of any kind that that's the case.
And President Biden says he will not interfere or he will not pardon his son.
In fact, yeah, President Biden said that he would not pardon his son. He's made that point extremely clear.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, great to talk to you. Always appreciate your perspective. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Defense attorney Jack Rice speaking with VOA's Lori London. Ironically, on the day the gun case closed with a guilty verdict for his son, President Biden showcased his administration's efforts to cut down on illegal gun trafficking and reduce crime at a gun violence prevention summit. Here's Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner with more on that.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday touted his efforts to reduce gun violence and called for further restrictions on firearms at a rally in Washington.
Who in God's name needs a magazine which can hold 200 shells?
Nobody, that's right.
The event highlighting his efforts to curb illegal guns came just hours after his son, Hunter Biden, was criminally convicted for illegally possessing a firearm while using drugs. On stage, the Democratic president did not mention his son's conviction. He spoke instead about his visits with families who had lost loved ones to gun violence and pointed toward the two-year anniversary of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act.
It's the most significant gun legislation in nearly 30 years. It was designed to reduce gun violence and save lives, and I'm so proud of the tremendous progress we've made since then.
That legislation was spurred by mass shootings at a Texas elementary school and a New York supermarket. The law established new criminal offenses for the straw purchasing of firearms by buyers who lie about the gun's intended owner, among other provisions. And Biden underscored what he said were the administration's investments in public safety.
You know, the year before I came to the presidency, the murder rate was the highest increase on record. Last year, we saw the largest decrease of murder in history.
Meanwhile, the Democratic president faces a tough battle against former President Donald Trump to win a second term in the November presidential election. Just last month, Trump won the endorsement of the nation's top gun rights group and has pledged to unravel gun regulations put in place by Biden.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. We're following these other stories from around the world. Hamas has responded to a proposed Gaza ceasefire deal by saying it opens up a wide pathway to reach an agreement. Hamas is still looking for a permanent ceasefire. A federal judge has struck down as unconstitutional a 2023 law in the U.S. state of Florida that blocked gender-affirming care for transgender minors and severely restricted treatments for adults. The judge ruled that the state went too far when it barred transgender minors from being prescribed puberty blockers and hormonal treatments with their parents' permission. Haiti's administration picked new ministers on Tuesday, rounding out the new prime minister's cabinet, a stark departure from the previous government as the country continues to battle a deep humanitarian crisis. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, wars in the Middle East and Europe and the U.S. rivalry with China will remain key issues to U.S. diplomats no matter who wins the November presidential elections. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadakaswara looks at the foreign policy priorities of the two candidates, Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
Picture the year 2025. A permanent ceasefire in Gaza could still be out of reach. A war of attrition still simmering in Ukraine, and China continues to be a threat. Whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump wins the presidency, these challenges will remain. Biden's second-term foreign policy will be based on the same principles as his first, global leadership and multilateralism.
The United States will compete and will compete vigorously and lead with our values and our strength. We'll stand up for our allies and our friends.
Plus, a focus on an area the administration believes it needs to improve on. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
It's a major initiative with the Congress aimed at truly delivering on the promise of unlocking resources for the developing world.
Development bank reforms and various infrastructure projects worldwide. The goal, to push back on China's global development initiatives by supporting various corridor projects around the world, such as the Lobito Corridor that connects Zambia, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola. Again, Jake Sullivan.
We can not only build out a transportation capacity to help ensure that we have the inputs for our clean energy supply chains, but also unlock Africa's vast agricultural potential by getting goods to market, and also unlock a digital transformation across that area.
If Trump wins, there won't be as much focus on international development.
Make America richer and safer and stronger and prouder and more beautiful than ever before. I think we have a final shot at it.
Although Trump's catchphrase is America first, it does not mean his foreign policy is isolationist, said Rachel Rizzo, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council.
Mercantilist, sure. Transactionalist, yes. But I think the most interesting part of his foreign policy is just the degree to which his vision of the tools of U.S. power be used in a different way.
Unwavering support for Israel, conditional aid to Ukraine, and a strong rivalry with China. These are foreign policy principles proposed for a second term by the Trump-affiliated think tank America First Policy Institute. Chad Wolf is the Institute's executive director.
Those are three areas that any incoming America First administration is going to have to deal with, and is going to have to put that peace through strength test, right? That approach to the test.
While we don't know who will win in November, we do know that foreign policy won't be the determining factor. Polls suggest most Americans are more concerned with inflation, the economy, immigration and crime than with U.S. engagements abroad. Pat Sumida Kuswara, VOA News, Washington.
More than 6,000 Ukrainians are being held prisoners of war by Russia. That number comes from Russian authorities. Now, there have been prisoner swaps between Russia and Ukraine, and for many of those Ukrainians released, freedom is just the start of a painful process of recovery. From Kyiv, Lysia Bakalets brings the story of one former POW.
With tears in his eyes, his legs shaking from tension, every day is a painful step in a complex process of rehabilitation for Ukrainian Marine Oleksandr Didur. Didur says the pain is such that he feels like he's in captivity again. He adds that on the pain scale of 0 to 10, he's at an 8 now. After Didur goes swimming, this routine is broken only for additional surgery. Since he was released from captivity a year ago, he's already had about 10 of them. Didur says he had his left hand reassembled and two eye surgeries. From his mouth, doctors removed shrapnel from a mine explosion injury. In a semi-kosher state, Oleksandr fell into Russian captivity along with other Ukrainian soldiers from the Azovstal steel plant in May 2022. A UN report in March concluded the torture of Ukrainian POWs in Russian internment is widespread. The same report says Russian POWs were tortured by Ukrainian forces while in transit. Both Russian and Ukrainian officials have said they respect the rights of prisoners. Oleksandr was held captive for 15 months before returning to his family as part of a prisoner exchange nearly a year ago. Without one eye and with three remaining fingers on his right hand, Didur does his best to get back to normality. Each day brings pain, but also progress, and he thinks of how each day brings him closer to not only recovery, but the release of his comrades who are still held captive. Lysia Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. The Humboldt penguin population along the central coast of Chile has dramatically decreased, making them one of the most vulnerable of the world's 18 penguin species and putting them at risk of extinction. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn with more.
A survey of two islands in the area last year detected 842 Humboldt penguin breeding pairs or active nests. This year, they found just one breeding pair. Veterinarian Paulina Arce specializes in penguins. She says island surveys over the past decades have either shown a decrease or the same level of penguin and nest populations. None has seen an increase.
Therefore, we believe that this decreasing trend will continue and can reach a more drastic scenario, which would be the extinction of this species.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. And finally, there's a club in a posh Southern California neighborhood that has gone to the dogs. Dogs are living it up at Dog People, a private member's dog park for canines in the Los Angeles beach enclave of Santa Monica, where dogs and their owners socialize and enjoy high-end amenities in what's been dubbed Soho House for Dogs. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino has more.
At this Los Angeles members-only club, scoring an invite is all about who you know.
The humans are a guest of their dog who is the member.
This is Dog People, a private dog park where canines and their owners can socialize while enjoying high-end amenities.
We have parties here. We have events here, programming. We have yoga classes. We've had 100 tons of snow dumped into the park because most of our dog members had never seen snow before, we found out. So we're like, okay, why don't we bring the snow to them?
Memberships cost $120 a month. And like other clubs, not just anyone can join.
Hi, bud.
Once in, the canines get access to a clean and luxurious place to hang out. So-called referees keep an eye out in case any of the dogs get too excited. And for the humans, there's a lounge, bar, work areas, and social events. While the focus is on the dogs, their humans say they're happy to sit and stay for a while, too.
It's facilitated a lot of things for me, business, personal.
I mean, I'm from L.A., so everything that, like, kind of people judge about L.A., I think is, like, what makes L.A. so unique.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reporting. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. You can also download our app from Apple and Google. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The right time for defense leaders to talk is any time and every time, said U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin after meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Defense Minister Dong Jun, in Singapore.
There's no substitute for open lines of communication to avoid misunderstanding and miscalculations. As I've always said, dialogue is not a reward. It's a necessity.
The face-to-face talks between the military leaders took place on May 31st on the sidelines of the Shangri-La Dialogue Defense Forum. It was the first in-person meeting between top U.S. and Chinese defense chiefs in over 18 months. Secretary Austin called the discussion frank and open. In a readout, the Pentagon noted, among other issues, Secretary Austin voiced concern about provocative actions taken by China against Taiwan in the aftermath of the election of Taiwan's new president. Secretary Austin underscored U.S. commitment to its longstanding one-China policy and reaffirmed the need for peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. Secretary Austin also emphasized the importance of freedom of navigation guaranteed under international law, especially in the South China Sea. He reiterated the United States' determination to fly, sail, and operate responsibly wherever international law allows. In discussing the meeting, Secretary Austin reiterated that every country, large or small, has the right to enjoy its own maritime resources and to freely sail and operate wherever international law allows.
We all share an interest in ensuring that the South China Sea remains open and free. Peace and stability across this region are crucial for the whole world.
Defense Secretary Austin said, what we're looking for in our relationship with China is a relationship based upon competition. We're not looking for a contentious relationship, but we really have to be clear about our expectations.
And the issues that we see that are very, very troubling. And if we have an open dialogue, we can address those issues in those channels.
Leaders of great powers, declared Secretary Austin, need to continue to work together to ensure that we're doing things to reduce the opportunities for miscalculation and misunderstanding. And every conversation is not going to be a happy conversation, but it is important that we continue to talk to each other.
That was an editorial reflecting